Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Windows Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Windows Weekly, episode 154 for April 30th, 2010. Are you glistening? Windows Weekly is brought to you by GoToTraining. Improve learning, participation, and access to training programs, plus save a bunch with GoToTraining. For a free trial, visit GoToTraining.com. And by Audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to Audible.com/Windows. And by the new Carbonite Pro. It's simple, secure, and affordable online backup for your small business. For a free trial and to learn more, visit CarbonitePro.com. It's time for Windows Weekly, the show that covers everything that's coming out of the great state of Washington. Well, everything coming out of the great state of Washington in the Redmond area.
Apples, wine, honey.
Apples, wine, honey, and Windows. Here he is, our Apple, wine, honey, and Windows editor, Mr. Paul Thurrott, editor-in-chief of the Supersite for Windows, winsupersite.com. What a great site that is. Also, news editor for Windows IT Pro, author of Windows 7 Secrets, the new book, Windows Phone Secrets, is out sometime.
Right Windows.
About, Windows Phone.
Windows.
Secrets.
Whatever that thing is.
Well, I mean, we're getting this, I think, yeah, because.
I'm with you.
You know what I mean?
I do.
You know what I'm saying?
I think we don't even have to explain it.
No, I think it speaks for itself.
It's self-evident.
No, the big story, of course, and you broke it yesterday when we were doing This Week in Google, HP purchases Palm.
Yeah.
For like $1 trillion.
I haven't done a double take that serious. I almost hurt my neck, you know?
What?
And it was weird because we were just starting up, and I think the question was literally something like, Paul, what do you think about that? And I was like, you know, something like that.
It's starting to make a little bit more sense, but what it, I mean, on a larger level, what it shows you is any PC company at this point, whether it's Dell, whether it's HP, whether it's Apple, is starting to look to mobile as the future, right?
Right. Well, I mean, I am so infrequently right about anything, but I will say, I've been saying for a long time, you know, the future of computing is mobile and connected. And that is exactly the way that HP described this future that they see for themselves as the HP experience spanning multiple mobile connected devices. Exactly the way, you know, the phrase I've been using in a way. It's really interesting. So,
echoes a little bit the phrase that Apple has used for a while, mm-hmm. which is put. In fact, I remember Microsoft used to say a PC. What was it? A PC in every home running.
In every home. And then it was on every desk.
And on every desk. They're running Windows.
I mean, now it's in every pocket, you know?
Yeah, it's not enough to say, I want one on my desk.
In fact, being chained to a desk is old fashioned.
Right. It's really interesting to see this shift.
Now, as obvious as this looks in retrospect, I mean, I have to say, I was very surprised to see that HP bought these guys. You know, they are the number one PC maker by far worldwide, but they have almost zero. Imprint at all in the mobile world, smartphones especially.
Do a smartphone though still, right?
Yeah, they make something called the iPac Glisten, which is terrible. I know, it's hard to say without laughing.
Sorry.
Well, it's a Treo style smartphone. You know, it's based on an older version of Windows Mobile. It's sold exclusively to businesses essentially.
Right. The iPac is the old that's the old Compaq brand. So got that. I remember those iPacs were actually great for one
they
brief
were.
Shining
and,
moment.
And
they were
that brief moment in time when pocket PC based PDAs were kind of a big deal. Compaq owned the market. They with the iPac, those things they had kind of a sled. You could slide onto the back of them and you could plug in.
Oh yeah.
Things right. So they had the one with the Compaq. Flash type of connector, and you could put a Wi-Fi card in there and get online with it and everything. It was very leading edge. And it was crazy. You know, some of these packs were huge, so there would be an extra battery in there and two slots, and you know, they'd triple the size of the device and the weight of the device. But
didn't they I think they had a GPRS radio, a phone data radio as well, as I remember.
Yeah,
all sorts of crazy stuff.
Yeah. But they were, you know, for a little while there, those little stylus-based iPacks were kind of a big deal. And obviously, as the PDA world turned into smartphones, there have been iPac smartphones, but they just really haven't taken off the market. For a while, it was Palm, and then, of course, RIB and other Windows mobile makers, and then finally the iPhone came along. And, you know, that world has changed pretty dramatically. So iPac is still around as a brand, but it's really not a big deal like it used to be.
It's funny how our reaction initially was unexpected, and then afterwards, oh,
yeah,
I guess that makes sense. I mean,
it does. I mean, it. The other options for HP obviously would have been continue down the Microsoft path,
right?
And they could have made Windows Phone devices, and maybe still will. I mean, this is very up in the air. It's kind of a question.
They're being a little cagey on that matter.
Yeah, yeah, and probably on purpose. I'm sure. You know, they could also go the Android route. But a lot of other companies are doing that, and it's not clear, you know, for example, if Dell puts out Android phones, you know, they're just one of many Android phone, you know, and it's not necessarily a huge differentiator. I think for companies like HTC that make Android devices, that makes a lot of sense. But for really big companies like Dell or HP, you know, it's kind of up in the air if latching on to something like that makes any sense at all.
I think it's kind of brilliant in hindsight. I mean, it's risky. It makes more sense than, say, HP Compaq made sense. That was a really bizarre move, and I think ultimately not such a great move for HP. But this makes a lot of sense. This bolsters a category that they're weak in. It is clearly an important category. You're exactly right. Doing another Android or Windows mobile phone doesn't differentiate them much. So it's really just a question of, and I'll pose this to you, is WebOS good enough? Is there enough of an ecosystem? Is it worth saving?
Right. Well, I will say this. From a technical perspective, WebOS absolutely is good enough. In fact, you know, we've talked about this a little bit. I mean, when you sort of survey the field of modern smartphone platforms, I mean, WebOS is right up there. It's beautiful looking. A little slow on that first generation of devices. I haven't tried any of the Plus phones, you know, pre-plus or Pixie and plus, but I assume that's been
none of them though
addressed.
None of them are gigahertz, which is really, really kind of now the standard. These snap
like a single, yeah,
gigahertz Snapdragon processor.
Well, there's no reason that couldn't happen. I mean, the one thing that Palm didn't have, it was money,
right?
And when you don't have money, you don't get distribution. You don't, you know, as their market share and these other devices were just falling through the floor, they didn't really have a chance to get the WebOS off the ground. And the one thing HP brings to the party. Well, actually, they didn't bring a number of things, but the big thing, of course, is money.
And channel. And they also have,
distribution.
Huge channel, yeah.
So, you know, we'll see. I mean, HP, you know, there are pluses and minuses to HP. I like HP a lot, but on the other hand, they tend to name products like the, you know, DY13897Z, and it's not clear what kind of product I'm talking about. Is it a laptop? Is it an all-in-one printer? Is, you know, they have a kind of a branding problem. I was interested in paying attention to what they were saying at their little press conference. They said WebOS a lot, so you get the feeling that's coming along. They didn't say Palm a lot, you know, and I'm a little nervous that they might try to get rid of the Palm brand, and I actually think that Palm is an important brand. Now, you could do an HP Compaq type thing where it becomes HP Palm, but I think they need to be careful about that. My advice would be to leave that Palm brand alone because I think Palm still has a good name.
They kept Compaq. They, for a long time.
It's sort of, yeah.
But mostly because that's Compaq was big in business, and they were going after that enterprise stuff, right?
But that stuff, you know, to me, the Compaq HP today is like Chevy Pontiac was for a long time. You know, they build these devices that are very similar. You know, obviously the same underneath, slightly different skins. I'm not really a big fan of that kind of business model, but
they kept the Voodoo name. Somebody's pointing out that was the last big acquisition a couple of years ago. Big,
yeah,
small.
That's true.
But,
sure. So what I hope to see from them is they keep Palm. They keep obviously. Well, they're going to keep WebOS. They've said very explicitly we're going to make smartphones and we're going to make tablets. And you know, people ask, well, what about this HP Slate thing you've been talking about? Is that still going to be Windows 7? Is it going to be WebOS? Oh. And they don't want to talk about that.
I want to, you know what? Slate to me is not interesting as Windows 7. That's just another tablet.
Yeah.
Slate to me with WebOS is very interesting.
Yeah, maybe. When I look at these devices that are not quite smartphones and not quite computers, I have to say, you know, one of the things I like about the iPad, and I think this would be true of WebOS, and it would be even more true, I think, of Windows Phone, is these smartphone OSs lend themselves pretty well to slightly bigger form factors. WebOS is beautiful looking. You know, you've seen it. I mean, it's really nice looking. I think it would make a nice tablet OS, I guess, you know. In fact, it's, you know, and not again to harp on the iPad. I think one of the things I don't like about the iPad is just that they didn't do enough to differentiate the UI. It's really just kind of an exploded view of what, you know, was already on the iPhone or whatever. You know, we talked about Windows Phone and how it has that beautiful panoramic UI and how that would be so cool on a bigger device because you could see more of the screen and it would lend itself very well to that. You know, hopefully HP or Palm will do something more along those lines than just, you know, explode the UI up to a bigger size.
Well, here's the great news. There's going to be some competition in a segment, and I think that's great. And some variety, some choice. I am underwhelmed by the idea of putting a desktop OS on a slate or a tablet or a pad or whatever.
Well, this all boils down to the same thing. And unfortunately for Palm and HP, the fact remains, and there's nothing they can do to fix this. You know, whatever the pluses and minuses are of the iPad and that whole thing, the big plus, the biggest plus, is that iTunes ecosystem, and they can never overcome that. And however many applications come out for Android, however many applications come out for the Palm OS or Windows Phone, whatever, it's never going to matter. You know, it's never going to be the same. And they're never going to have that cohesive thing. So, you know, where are they going to get content from? You know how you have a Nexus One. So, you know, where do you get music from? Where do you get movies from? Where do you get ebooks from? You know, on Apple, it's all from the same place. And it's in, again, for all the pluses or minuses there, it is an integrated experience. It's everything you need all in one place. And this is not something that any of the competition, including Microsoft, can offer. Although, I mean, arguably Microsoft of all these companies has the best chance of offering an alternative. But even on the Microsoft side, I don't see them ever offering anything as extensive as what Apple can do.
Right.
It's a tough thing. So it's nice that there's competition.
But if anybody could do it, it would be Palm, right?
Well, do what? Compete with Apple?
I mean, HP Palm. I don't know. I'm sorry. You're already calling
it. By the way, it would be very instructive for people, and I did this myself recently, to go and look at, if you go to YouTube, Palm has a channel up there like you do. And it's a small channel. They only have a couple of things. But one of the more recent videos is John Rubenstein talking at CES this past year. And he's talking, it's sort of an update, like this is how the last year went. Here's our new products that we're shipping on Verizon. We're going to Europe. You know, it's a whole thing. And when you watch this, you realize very quickly, this is an Apple keynote, right?
Uh-huh.
It is structured exactly like an Apple, except it's being delivered by a guy who has absolutely zero personality.
Right.
Well, I mean, and I'm not to be a jerk about it because...
No, we talked about this totally when it happened. I remember.
You really need to go back and watch this video. It's fascinating. And it shows you the problem that anyone will have competing with Apple because, you know, the WebOS technology looks awesome. It's a beautiful looking OS. It's technically excellent. You can make this keynote address that looks just like an Apple thing.
It did. John, you know, worked at Apple. He's totally copying it.
He totally copied it, and it just doesn't work. You know, Apple is the unique sum of many pieces, right. And it's hard to put a finger on exactly that one thing that makes it all work. But, you know, when you're missing any of it, you get stuff like that.
I guess you're right. I guess that's
close. It's close, you know, but...
But, again, HP is the largest computer company in the world, right? Or at least in the U.S., if not the world.
No, in the world. They're only number two in the U.S., believe it or not, but they're number one worldwide.
So they have huge resources. They can hire anybody they want. They can, you know, I think they can coerce developers. They, you know, into participate. I mean, I think as a developer now you have four, maybe five if you include.
I think the
RIM.
Big thing that they're going to do is be able to put financial resources behind this thing,
right?
And that will be interesting. But I think, you know, again, at the end of the day, they're not. This is a smartphone OS that has a very tiny market share, so. They're never going to be 30%, right? I mean, they're always going to be kind of a minority player, but hopefully they can be a lot bigger than they are now.
Yeah.
You know? But, yeah, no, it's big. I mean,
I love competition. I just think that, you know, as much as I love the iPad, I'd like to see this category see some real strong competition. And I think Android and WebOS both would do very well. And Windows Phone would do very well in this form factor, and I'd love to see it. They're all multi-touch, right?
Yep.
They all have essentially the same kind of DNA, which is designed for a touch device with your web style. WebOS development is something people under. I think it's the JavaScript HTML CSS thing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Yeah.
So people know how
they do a very nice. Their implementation of multitasking is fantastic. In fact, it's one of the things I really like about.
I agree.
WebOS. So I think that's the standard that others need to follow. It's just very well done.
You just slide the. You can have all these things running. And you slide them around, so they all stay there. I mean,
these devices would benefit greatly from a faster processor. And I know that the new versions have more RAM, which I assume clears up some of the issues.
But I think I think a gigahertz is now the minimum.
Yeah. They did the integrated inbox thing first.
I loved the Pre. When I got the Pre, you remember, for 5 days.
Yeah.
I was very impressed. It was a little sluggish. Was my only complaint.
It's really the first thing you kind of notice, and it's unfortunate because that's an awful problem to have.
You know? No, and in fact, it's interesting because the thing you notice immediately first on the iPad is snappy.
Oh, and by the way, that's absolutely true. Yeah,
and it's funny. I mean, I know
it's shockingly snappy.
Yeah, and that makes for a good experience. That's a lot of the experience. No,
you're right. And so the iPad is instant on. The performance is unbelievable and never gets bad. You know, there's never that one thing that makes it slow down. And then the battery life is stupid long. I mean, it's just. I could make a career out of complaining about the battery life of other Apple products, but there's something about the iPad, it just works.
Right.
You know? Sure. So there you go. I've complimented the iPad. Are you happy?
You're a tool. I'm just teasing you.
Just being honest.
I want to do an iPad show, and I'm going to have Paul be on as the anti-editor, and he's just going to come on every show and go, "What are you, crazy?" And that's it. Maybe call his tools.
It would just be a different version of that reaction. It would be like, you know, you'd be like, "So, Paul, what do you think about this?" And I'll just be like,
That's good. That's good. I can go with that. Do we get that on tape, Tony? Okay, we got it. You don't have to ever come back. We just run that over and over.
Or just the better one will just be I'll just be like silent and like rubbing my temples. Like, oh. You know, that kind of thing.
Good. We got that on tape, too. We're set. You don't have to ever come in. The check will be in the mail. That's called Skyping it in.
Mailing it in.
That's
what it's called.
The modern version. All right. We have much more to talk about.
Yes, we
do. We're finally going to take a look at Windows Live Wave 4.
Yep. I know. I'm so excited.
Windows Embedded. I know you're so excited about that, too.
Actually, I kind of am excited about that.
So, I want to ask about the HTC settlement because I want to know what that means. We've got Windows features of the week, Windows tip of the week, software picks, two of them at least. Paul's wants to deliver more towards the end.
I can't help it.
He feels guilty.
Stuff happens, Leo.
He says, I can't leave like this. I got to give you one more thing. In fact, you do look like
Jobs.
Are you wearing blue jeans? Because you got the black T-shirt on there.
I am wearing blue jeans.
It's perfect. It's good.
I'll put the camera down here.
No, no, no. That's good. Stop. I want to tell everybody about GoToTraining, and then we'll get back to the latest news from Redmond. GoToTraining is from our friends at Citrix. It is fan-freaking-tastic. I told this story the other day. I work for Clear Channel for Premier. They're my radio syndicator, and as all I think radio companies are wont to do these days, but especially Clear Channel because they got a pretty big fine a few years ago. They make you go through every year training, basically profanity training. How not to say booger on the air? Ooh. So I have to take this thing. But they're not using GoToTraining. They're using some, I don't know what, e-learning system. It doesn't work. I can't use it on a Mac. I can't use it outside of their intranet. I have to VPN to their intranet. Every year I go through this with like 5 or 6 calls to the IT department to get it so I can take this stupid training. And you know what? I've yet to been able to break through. I still haven't taken it, which is why I keep saying booger. And this is from the folks at Citrix. They know how to make this work. You know, they know how to do they do NAT traversal, so it installs easily. It works everywhere. It is a web-based tool. You can get up to 200 people on live training sessions from their desktop. And then you can record what you're doing, and it's available on demand forever. So it's a great way to train employees or customers wherever they are. In fact, you can even have trainers in multiple sites and pass control from one to the other anywhere in the world. Of course, there's screen sharing. There's voice over IP. So this is super cool. You know, you can do this just with a headset. You don't have to make a phone call or anything. They're there. You can hear. You can talk to your trainees. You can have interactive tests, polls, quizzes. You can create a training library containing any document type or a link to any website that they're available for them before, during, and after training. You could schedule the training. There's a registration form capability. You can create your own forms, create your own tests. You can even send out invites or notices from within the training. Where are you? We're doing. We're starting. You get feedback. There's an integrated chat window, polling. I mean, this thing is, when they do it, I have to say, these guys at Citrix, they know what they're doing. They over-design. They build it in. They really make it solid. Now, this is brand new. This just came out. So I want you to try it free for 30 days. Go right now to gototraining.com. gototraining.com, and you can test drive it free for 30 days if you're a trainer. If you're a person like me who's been suffering through the Byzantine corporate training system, tell them about this. There's no reason to suffer. gototraining.com. The folks at Citrix know how to make stuff fast, easy, effective. gototraining.com. Thank you, Citrix, for your support, continued support of Windows Weekly. You've really been a great partner for us. So, speaking of HP, other companies make Windows Home Server, but HP is like, that's the one you like, the MediaSmart.
Yeah, that's the one I use, yeah.
And it seems like the one everybody is kind of going for.
Yeah. There are others, and I'm sure some of them are okay, but there's something...
It's beautiful.
Wonderful about it.
It works. Yeah,
it's really,
now,
really well done.
If you're running... If you buy one today, what version of WHS are you running?
So it's the initial version. It's been updated 3 or 4 times, depending on how you look at it. So they've come up with 3 power packs, which are essentially like feature pack, you know, functional updates. And then there's been an update roll up, you know, that rolls up all of the updates.
Is it Windows Server, basically? I mean, what is it?
Yeah, it's basically. A version of Windows Server that's been customized in a certain way. You know, it doesn't have all the domain stuff by default, you know, that you get in the upper end versions. And it's aimed at the home, you know, obviously. So it's designed to work around things like, you know, media sharing and remote access and, you know, centralized PC backup and centralized, you know, network health monitoring and so forth.
So they just clean it up and make it consumer friendly.
Yeah.
It's Server 2003, 2008.
Yeah, so I mean that's the thing. So the current version has been around for a few years now, but it's based on Windows Server 2003.
Okay,
and it's also a 32-bit product, for whatever that's worth. So there are some limitations around that.
Well, how does that matter in a server, though?
Well, because it can only support up to 4 gigs of RAM for starters.
Do you need more?
You might. I would say for the current version, you don't. You know, but as we look ahead, you know, one of the things we've known for a long time is that the next version of Windows Home Server will be 64-bit. It's going to be based on Windows Server 2008 R2. And it, you know, the potential is there for a much higher end product. Now, they're not talking yet about what they're going to do around the different product versions, but I think we might see some interesting different versions of Home Server for this next version.
So Vail is...
Vail is the code name for that next version.
But it's still
Windows Home Server. So Vail is the 64-bit next-gen version. This is true next-gen.
Cool.
It's neat, but, you know, there are also some, you know, some issues around it. So if you're an enthusiast like I am who's really into Windows Home Server, you know, one of the issues you're going to have is that there's no direct upgrade path between 32-bit versions of Windows, 64-bit versions.
Right.
That's true on the desktop. It's true on the server as well. Now, okay, you know, fair enough. So I can't do an in-place upgrade. You may not want to anyway. These things have been around for a while. You know, a clean install might be better. Anyway, but there's also no real data portability story. So you're really going to have to manually copy your files over.
Oh boy,
to the new server, which is a little tough. But
could you restore a backup? I mean, is there some?
Yeah, you could, but I mean, honestly, I think if you just did some kind of a RoboCopy, XCopy type thing, it'd probably just be as fast. I mean, the thing I would just point out to people, because this is somewhat disappointing to the enthusiasts who, you know, have kind of rallied around this thing for a couple of years now. You know, Windows Home Server is really designed to be like an appliance. You know, it's not like your PC. I mean, it's meant to sit there in the corner and serve up media and all that kind of stuff. And you know, if you never upgraded the thing, it would work for years and it would just be fine. I mean, but if you want that new functionality that's coming in the next version, I think what you're really looking at is probably getting a new server.
All new hardware. Yeah.
I mean, I think it's, I understand why people are upset about that missing bit of functionality there, but I also understand why they're doing it the way they're doing it. And, you know, it's a little bit of a stretch, but I mean, you know, you buy a DVD player, you don't expect to be able to upgrade it to Blu-ray, you know. It's not a computer.
Well, see, that's the thing. It kind of feels like a computer. So I can understand.
No, it actually, of course, it is under the covers. But it's meant to be used by normal people.
It's meant
to be used as an appliance. Yeah. So yeah, of course. I mean, you can RDP into the thing. You can, you know, the systems are headless.
You can pee into it.
RDP.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought said you could already pee into it. And yeah, I thought, wow.
It functions as a urinal.
That's really...
it's very multi-purpose.
Above and beyond.
No, it's a... You know, the boxes as they're sold by PC makers don't come with keyboard, mouse, or monitor connections. They're headless. So it really is meant to be... Plug it into the network and you're done. It's meant to be an appliance, you know, that sits on your network. You interact with it via a remote console that, you know, that you can bring up on your PCs. You install a connector software on each of the PCs and it does its thing. Every night it will back up your computers and so forth. It's just meant to sit in the background and do its thing. So I get it. It's a server. It really is a computer. You should be able to upgrade it. I mean, you know, I do understand, but as excited as those people are, this enthusiast market, they're also sort of a small part of the market and not really the target, right? I mean, the core user base for this thing is supposed to be normal, you know, normal people. I'm not to say it like that, but, you know, home users, typical consumers.
So now I'm kind of glad now I didn't buy one. I'll just buy one when Veil comes out. When are we going to see that?
They're not saying, but given the fact that they just shipped a public preview, I think we can expect to see this thing by the holidays. Yeah. Yeah.
And
it looks great. I mean, it is fantastic. Like I said, I use Home Server literally as the basis of my entire computing infrastructure here at home.
Yeah.
And
that's,
you know,
I've influenced me, actually, frankly.
Yeah. It's fantastic. And it's always worked really, really well. And, you know, the new version looks great. There's some interesting changes and some interesting improvements and so forth. There's some stuff that isn't happening. You know, one of the things I had heard about was that they were going to integrate some media center functionality into the server. They're not actually going to be doing that. But I think overall it's, you know, it's kind of exactly what we were looking for in many ways. You know, it integrates with home groups on Windows 7. It does remote media sharing outside of your network now. So now from a Windows 7 PC out in the world, you'll be able to access your entire media collection over the internet and stream it, you know, to the client from wherever you are, which is fantastic.
And it has pretty good security on that, I would assume.
Oh, yeah. That's the media sharing stuff is basically DLNA type sharing. And then it uses, you know, the Play 2 stuff in Windows 7. So it's nice.
So those of us who already have Windows Home Server.
Yep.
Will there be any upgrade path at all? No.
No.
That's it. But it works. You don't need an upgrade path. It works.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, you know, for all of the complaining, confronted with the ability to upgrade my server to this version, I would never do that anyway.
You wouldn't want to do it.
Yeah.
I think this is a disconnect between people who think of it as a computer and people who think of it as an appliance. And
right.
For most home right. users, it's an appliance. You don't sure. upgrade your NAS.
Yeah, right. So the issue, of course, is that these machines have massive quantities of storage in some cases. So the deal, and of course, Windows Home Server has amazing data duplication functionality. Super simple. You just click a switch and, you know, whatever the file share is, everything in that share will be written to two different physical disks. So in the event of a hardware failure, you won't lose your data, hopefully, unless, you know, both disks somehow fail at the same time. It's neat. But that creates a little bit of a problem, you know, and this is one of the things we talked about a little bit recently where I have terabytes of storage on my Windows Home Server. Now, this makes it a problem for backing up to the cloud because there's a lot of stuff there. Where could I go that this would be, you know, not prohibitively expensive? But now I have terabytes of storage and now I need to get it to a new home server. Well, you know, how do you do that? Am I going to go buy the same amount of storage? And or more, you know, and plug it into the new server because that would be the only way I could do it. Yeah, you know, maybe you're going to have to do that. So it's a concern, you know, if all of your stuff is in this one place, you know, you have to essentially duplicate the environment, you know, in order to have enough space. So it's just something you have to think about.
I'm just thinking about it. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to. That okay. sound, that nothing you heard, that's me thinking.
I heard a little ticking sound. It's like an engine that doesn't have enough oil.
I got tappets. Microsoft is beginning to preview Windows Live Wave 4. We talked about Wave 4 last week.
Yeah, so very vaguely, last week they had said, you know, Wave 4 is coming. We're going to start talking about it. You know, here are three of the big themes. And they talked about, you know, Messenger and Hotmail and also Windows Live Essentials. And this week, they announced all of the features that are going to be in the Messenger application, which is part of Windows Live Essentials and their instant messaging application. And it's pretty clear now, you know, when you see how they're doing this, that they're basically going to slowly reveal all of these applications, you know, one at a time. So Windows Live Messenger is actually something I do use every day. It's not a program I can claim to love. It's a way to communicate with people who are friends or coworkers or family in some cases. And it's, you know, it's instant as instant messaging would be. But I'm obviously outside of the target market for people that are going to be, you know, texting all day long. But, you know, Messenger is growing up and turning into an application that, you know, integrates with all of your social networking stuff online. And on that note, it's actually pretty interesting. And it utilizes that whole Windows Live infrastructure they have for aggregating content from social networks and so forth and, you know, photo sharing and all that stuff. So they're finally opening the kimono, I guess, is the way I would describe it. I mean, it's been a slow, slow process, but it seems like finally they're starting to talk. So if you go, actually, let me see if the site was down, but let me just check. Yeah, so it's back up. So there's a website called WindowsLivePreview.com. And if you go to this website, what you'll be able to see is not just a bunch of screenshots, but also video showing this application off. And you can see that there's a single tab at the top just for Messenger. But over time, they're going to be adding tabs for all the other applications and services. So as these things are unveiled over time. And there'll be public betas, both of the services like Hotmail and then of the, you know, the end user applications, I think, over the course of the summer. And then probably by the end of the year. But one of the things they also announced was Microsoft's, it's not their first ever, but I would say their first ever, well, actually it's the second major iPhone application is going to be Windows Live Messenger for iPhone. And there's some screenshots of that and so forth.
Yeah, that's kind of neat. Yeah, now Apple has to approve it, but I don't see why they wouldn't.
That's a good point. Yeah, I assume it's been, right, they're showing it off, yeah, so.
Right. Well, this happens all the time now. This is kind of the new strategy to get your stuff on the iPhone, is
yeah,
say,
that's right.
We've submitted it.
Well, this is one of the ones I've known about for a while. I mean, at some point had talked to Microsoft, and there's a bunch of iPhone stuff coming, and, you know, there's a Bing application now, of course, and now they have Messenger coming, but presumably, assuming they all get approved, there'll be more. So there's the start of that kind of stuff. So interesting.
Yeah. You know what would be very interesting is if Apple and Microsoft have some sort of partnership and this possible front-facing camera that we seem to think is going to be on the iPhone 4 would work with Messenger.
Yeah, there's no reason it wouldn't. So
well, it's, well, wait
well I'm sorry.
Slow
me,
down,
sorry.
Buddy.
There's no technical reason why that couldn't happen.
Did you see Jobs Today published a letter on the front page of the Apple site?
So I can't disagree with this guy more, and I'm not sure how much I want to get into that, but
you didn't put it in your rundown. I'm springing this on you, but
no, I didn't put it on my site yet because honestly, this is the type of thing I can't have a knee-jerk reaction to because I want to get it right.
I want to think about it. If you go to apple.com, there's a link to thoughts on Flash.
And I just find this to be very self-serving, and I want to ask you because there's just a couple of things I just want to touch on that are in here. First of all, WebKit is not a single thing, right? I mean, actually, these different browsers all render differently, even though they all use WebKit. So it's not like the web has standardized on WebKit. I mean, I appreciate that, and I understand where he's coming from, but you know, every smartphone web browser other than Microsoft's uses WebKit, and that's cute. But you know, I also appreciate the way Microsoft is handling HTML5 and CSS and all that stuff. And their deal is, it shouldn't matter what the rendering engine is. There should be a consensus on how these things get rendered, you know, in a browser, right? Whatever the underlying technology is. You know, Microsoft wants the standard to be how things are rendered, right? Not that we have to use someone else's rendering engine. I actually think that makes more sense because that still allows people to compete on things like performance.
I agree. Yeah.
You know, this full web thing, you know, Adobe says that 75% of the video on the web is Flash. And then, you know, Jobs counters that, you know, there's a lot of video that isn't Flash and all that kind of stuff.
But there's more, you know, all the time, thanks to Apple. But
that's true. And that's getting better. But the truth is right now, you really don't get all of the web unless you have Flash. I mean, I hate Flash. I hate it with a burning passion, you know, and I understand that. But, you know, my kids do play Flash games. And, you know, saying that there are over 50,000 games and, you know, titles in the App Store is true, but it also doesn't address the fact that the games that my kids play on the web are not available on a flashless web browser, you know. But the thing I wanted to ask you about, because this comment has been made before, and I'm very, very confused about how this applies to the Apple environment, any Apple environment, which is he doesn't want a third party software maker,
right,
to allow, you know, to create an environment in which developers can create cross-platform applications because they've been burned by this before. How has Apple ever been burned by this? I don't understand this. Can you imagine if Microsoft said, we're not going to allow Adobe Air applications to run in Windows because these things create applications that run in multiple environments. That's what that really is, right?
Yeah, and I mean, certainly Air runs on OS X and Java does. I would say, if anything, Java Swing would be the culprit. Programs that are written in Java really don't give a very good experience on the Macintosh.
But how did Apple ever get burned by that?
But I don't know if they've ever been.
Well, that's what I mean. In other words,
I can't think of a way.
You know, the argument has been, we've been down this road before. It didn't work, and now we're not going to allow it.
I think there are a lot of spurious arguments in here, but I think that the arguments that really matter are there's no touch. It's a battery hog. It's unreliable. These technical reasons to me are more compelling than his, I agree with you, bogus,
stuff. In other words, if Adobe wanted to port Flash to iPhone, the fact that it has no touch or affects battery life or is unreliable or whatever, I mean, that's Adobe's problem, isn't it? I mean,
that's where Apple is
true.
It is true. That's where Apple's very different. I mean, look, there's Flash on the Android. It's not a good idea.
Yeah.
Apple is different.
I'm not defending Flash. I mean, like I said, I hate Flash. I'm just saying that, you know, this is almost like the Arizona immigration law. You know, there are probably really good reasons for some of it, but the sort of net effect is it's kind of scary, isn't it? I mean, this is a scary precedent. And I just, you know, I don't know.
If he did the same thing on the desktop, I would agree with you. If he said,
"Well, the desktop's not important anymore." I mean, well, to Apple, it's not.
I agree. But if he did the same thing on a desktop, which is a nominally much more open platform, I'd agree with you. On a closed platform like the iPhone and the iPad, I think...
Well, okay, but that's interesting that you say it that way. So I was trying to figure out, like, why is a cell phone or, you know, a smartphone platform more important or need to be protected more than the Mac or the PC? I mean, what, you know, this, like, it's like Flash is okay on this other thing, but now on this new one, we're not going to allow this.
I give you a few reasons.
Okay.
First of all, it's a highly resource constrained environment. So low RAM, low CPU, battery life is a big issue. So I think that's why I say, for instance, the interface on the iPad and the iPhone is touch, and Flash doesn't support it, period.
Well, presumably, if they were going to make it for the iPhone, it would.
Well, so. And see, that's the issue. Now, I'm not, by the way, I'm not defending Apple. I'm just, I'm gonna give you the reasons, the arguments in this case. That's a legitimate complaint that I think people. Again, I agree with you. It's anti-competitive. It's very closed. For him to say we're open is bogus.
Oh, it's terrible.
It's certainly his right to do it, and I think that there are. And it's good business to do it. And I think there are arguments. He doesn't make them very compellingly, completely, but there are arguments for doing it. This argument against third-party platforms is chiefly this. We are then at the mercy of the features that are supported in the third-party tool.
I completely understand that. But, you know, is this because, you know, Adobe Photoshop for Mac OS X ship later than Jobs would have liked, and this is like, screw you, you were late once and we're not going to allow you to be late on us again? I mean, is there some precedent for, you know, third party, I don't know what they would be called, application frameworks not keeping up to date with the lower level frameworks that are created by the platform maker, and thus the developers that use those other tools are somehow not able to take advantage of the most recent features? I mean, is there actually some history that you can point to something and say, look, this guy's got burned really bad by this.
Well, so, not really burned really bad, no. But you can give, but the history of Java Swing is a very good example of a kind of intermediate development platform that gives you less than sterling results.
From a developer perspective, if you had said to me, I don't know, 3 years ago, I guess we'd have to go back now, you know, one day, Objective-C and this crazy Apple environment is going to be the number one software development environment for mobile phones. I mean, this would have been a laughable statement. I have to think.
No, he didn't have the power to do it. Now he does.
No. I mean, no. In other words, like, this is going to be what happens. In other words, Objective-C is such a bizarre language. I mean, it never was going to be popular. How did this happen? You know, I mean, you have to kind of think that if iPhone developers could use something else that was simpler, they would, you know. It's astonishing.
I mean,
that there's no, they're limiting the choice of development environments. I mean, that's quite a limitation.
And if I were a developer, I'd be pissed. Although developers apparently don't seem to mind for the most part because they're making money. But I'll give you the similar example would be maybe Xbox 360 or Sony PS3. Sony PS3 is a bitch to develop for, really hard.
Yeah.
Not a desirable development environment. Do you have alternative tools? No. Would you, in fact, if you were developing for the Xbox 360 or the PS3, and there were third-party tools, there may be for all I know, would you choose to use them? No, because they're not to the metal and you need performance.
Right.
Now, I don't know. I don't know if Microsoft prohibits third-party tools. I would bet not. I think that's a weird thing
to
do.
I don't want to get too low level here, but I would say that the one primary developer advantage on the Microsoft side... And actually, I feel like there are more than one, but, you know, the big one, if I was going to pick one is, and actually it's funny because this doesn't apply to Windows Phone right now, is there is a .NET environment that is language agnostic, you know, that you can write .NET code in the language of choice. And one of the neat things that happened with the .NET framework and with .NET in general was that all of these third-party language developers came out with versions of their language that would write code that was, you know, compatible with .NET.
But that was because they wanted to do that, not, you know, I mean.
Well, it's open, though, in that sense.
Right.
In other words, the environment.
Yeah, that's interesting, because even if you wrote a tool, by the way, you don't have to use Objective-C. You could use anything that the Apple tools Xcode supports.
Well,
But it has to. You have to use Xcode.
I mean, I haven't looked at it recently, but I mean, when the first came out,
C, C++, Objective-C, Perl, Python, Ruby.
Okay, but everyone who's writing iPhone apps is writing Objective-C.
Because you want to write to the metal.
Well, okay. So, anyway. Well,
performance is important. And by the way, the jobs letter, somebody's pointing out in the chat room, the jobs letter only talks about Flash, not about this cross-development issue. Because I think that is a hot button issue, but it only talks about Flash.
It's mentioned in here. I mean, yeah, it is.
Okay.
It's one of the reasons they don't. Yeah, it is. Let me see. It's a huge letter, so let's see if I can find it.
He says he wants to get to H.264.
Yeah. Your comment about the Xbox 360 and PS3 environments is a good one because, you know, I think when you come from the PC world, as these phones do, but, you know, it's a different market. And maybe that's the important thing to remember. And by the way, if you're telling me that a smartphone platform would be better off with Flash, I am agreeing with you 100%. I think I'm worried about here isn't so much Flash or Adobe. I'm worried more about the implications that this has for other things, you know. He mentions in here, but it's, you know, Flash is a cross-platform development tool. Adobe does not have the goal to help developers write the best iPhone apps. It's their goal to help developers write cross-platform apps, you know. Sure. By the way, it would be the goal of a developer to write cross-platform apps as well. I mean, the iPhone has a huge market share, but how nice would it be to write one application that ran with some tweaking, right, on Windows Phone, on WebOS, on RIM BlackBerry, on Nokia, on whatever. I mean, it would be really nice to be able to repurpose a lot of your code. Now, that's something you can do in, you know, in the Microsoft environment. It's something you can do to some point if you're a Mac developer going to the iPhone. Absolutely. But that's kind of a small thing. I mean, it seems like developers who are creating iPhone apps don't have a concern about Mac OS X so much as they do about maybe doing this on the web and maybe on other mobile platforms. And that's where these cross platform development tools, not just Adobe's, but others would be really nice, you know. It's really restrictive, I think, what they're doing.
Yeah, here. And I think, you know, truthfully, the market.
And he does mention it. It's here it is. It's a little FU comment at the end. Adobe was the last major third-party developer to fully adopt Mac OS X. He still holds a grudge for that. That's like 8 years ago. No, I'm not kidding.
Well, he's saying that.
I remember
that,
they were complaining.
No, he's saying that it's only become fully Cocoa in CS5. This is just now, 2 weeks ago, Adobe finally used Cocoa.
Okay, I see. Okay. I mean, but the point, when Mac OS X shipped, he was on stage and he said, you know, we have developed, you know, Microsoft's going to make a version of theirs. Adobe's going to do theirs. And then remember Photoshop came out late, right? The Mac OS X version of Photoshop was late.
And Adobe decided that they were going to make the Windows version the primacy.
Well, the Windows version is the only one unless it's 64 bit. The 64 bit version is on Windows.
Well, I think that's the point is that this, I have to look, but I think CS5 now that's fully
Apple
Cocoa.
Punishing Adobe.
Oh, you might, believe me, Steve Jobs.
This is kind of messed up when you think about
Steve Jobs has no hesitancy in reaping revenge. I mean, there's no question about it.
Yeah, yeah.
My point is that there are multiple reasons for this. It's good business for Apple. Yeah. It's a screw you, Adobe. Yeah. There also are some legitimate reasons you can point to why this is good for an end user. That's not obviously the only reason Apple did it. Apple, if they were smart, would just focus on the good things for users and not mention any of these other things. I think Steve can't help but give a little zing to Adobe there. And I agree with you. I think this is what Apple, in fact, I said this yesterday on This Week in Google. Apple's very adept at spinning it.
Yeah.
There are multiple reasons for doing this. Clearly, it's good business more than anything else. The more closed the platform, the more they control it, the better it is for their business. But they can make a case that it's good for users, I think.
Maybe. I think it's bad for developers.
And I agree.
I think that's the thing that's tough about
Apple
this
hates developers. Apple's
I don't. Yeah, it's like, you know, these other companies want to create tools that make it easier for you to develop solutions that will work on multiple platforms. You know, we're not going to allow that to happen. You know, it's kind of
Apple. You know, Apple announced its WWDC is coming up in a month, a little more than a month, and they only now just set the dates.
Right.
I mean, costing developers a huge amount in plane tickets. Apple has never, not never, but often does not show much regard for its developers. It's like, you know, that you have to play their game, right? So I agree. I agree with you. I am not disagreeing with you. I think there are a lot of good arguments against doing this.
This is the type of thing. I mean, it would be inconceivable that Microsoft would try such a thing, but if they did, they would never be allowed to get away with this.
They could do it on the Windows phone, though.
I don't think they could.
No?
No. And
it's not their style.
The thing that's interesting about it is, you know, when Apple does this, there's just a discussion about it.
Oh, no. There's plenty of heat. Oh, no.
I don't mean like that. In other words,
Microsoft would have
been forced to backtrack. Right. Yeah, exactly. Right. You know, Apple, it's just like, well, let's just debate the merits of this, you know. They have some good reasons for doing it. They have some petty reasons, you know. It just becomes a discussion. But they're not going to change this. I mean, this is just, you know, deal with it. You know, it's very interesting. It's just something Microsoft couldn't get away with.
No, it's Apple being Apple.
Yeah.
That's what people say. Yeah, well, that's Steve. What are you going to do? And I think they only can get away with it to the degree that they make products that people want. As soon as, you know, if they were making products nobody wanted, A, there'd be no conversation about this. And B, everybody go, yeah, thanks. See ya.
Right. Well, I think that's why they can't do an app store on the Mac is because that platform is already too open.
And here's the good news.
They can control it.
Here's the good news.
Yeah.
There's competition now. I'm thrilled that HP bought Palm. Mm-hmm. You've got Windows Mobile. You've got Palm. BlackBerry has announced the new RIM OS is going to be spectacular, I think.
Yep.
Some big improvements there. They're going to use WebKit, I think. Is it WebKit? They're going to improve their browser immensely.
You're talking about RIM.
Yeah, the BlackBerry OS.
Not sure.
Android is a very strong competitor. So, you know, this is the good news. If it were just Apple in the space monopolistically dominating, it'd be more of a problem. You know, if you don't like it, do what I did. Buy an Android phone. Why are you laughing?
I don't know. It's like your token non-Apple device.
Oh, you see, you think I'm a tool. Where's my T-shirt?
I'm just trying to decide.
No, I use many non-Apple devices. And you're right, probably.
Only because they don't make cars.
No, I stick with Ford. I'm liking Ford more and more. And they're not an advertiser right now, but I have to say, you got to like what they've done, don't you?
Oh, no. The second I saw that,
They're becoming the Apple of the car world.
Wow.
That's kind of a curse. I shouldn't say that. Let's talk about embedded. You said you were excited about embedded.
And I'll tell you why, Leo.
Not yet.
Okay. Okay. I'll wait. I'll tell you why
later. Let's tease them in moments. Paul will tell you why he thinks embedded is exciting. You understand embedded is like for, you know, and firmware, Windows.
It makes servers look boring. Usually, but
I can't wait. I got to hear this one. Let me tell you about Carbonite Pro quickly before we do that. You know about Carbonite. I've told you about Carbonite before. It's the online backup solution that has all the features I think a great backup solution should have. It's automatic. You just go right now to Carbonite.com and use the offer code Windows, and you can try it on your computer, Mac or Windows, and it just starts backing up right away. In fact, that's what happened is that it's such a good solution that a lot of small businesses said, well, we don't have something this good, and they started using the consumer version of Carbonite. Carbonite said, wait a minute, we can do better than that for business, and they've created Carbonite Pro. Carbonite Pro has all of the great features of Carbonite. Automatic backup using AES 256-bit encryption. You control the key. Your data is private. Only you can access it. SSL, if you don't encrypt, you still have the encryption in the transmission. They're great servers. They're, you know, power conditioned, backed up, super duper servers. Store your data. You just know it's safe there. Easy to restore. That's important. And then the Carbonite Pro adds features like a single account for all your desktops and your whole enterprise, a single dashboard so you know which systems are backed up, which aren't. If you choose to, you can let your end users restore their files. Frankly, as somebody who'd worked in a corporation for a long time, that's nice if you accidentally delete something to be able to restore it yourself and not have to go to the IT department. You'll be notified if you choose, of course. The price, as low as $10 a month. And it really is affordable. In fact, if you've been using the consumer version, this will save you money. You can go to CarbonitePro.com and look at how the pricing structure works. But as an example, 8 computers, 5 gigs of backup, $25 a month. 18 computers, 5 gigs of backup, $50 a month. I mean, that's a lot of peace of mind. A lot more affordable, a lot more convenient than individual accounts, and it's designed for small business. Windows only for now. They are going to do a Mac version, I know. CarbonitePro.com. This is brand new from Carbonite, and I think a really good solution. We immediately set it up here at the cottage. I was very happy to hear about it because I was one of those people in multiple Carbonite consumer accounts. CarbonitePro.com. Give it a try today. So what does embedded even mean?
It means different things, Leo. But in this context, what we're talking about, Microsoft actually has several different embedded OSs, including that Windows Automotive product that's inside the Ford Sync system, right?
That's right.
They have the latest version of Windows CE, which I think is called Windows CE Embedded now, which literally dates back to that first Windows CE version that became, you know, the palm-sized PC and the pocket PC and Windows Mobile and all that kind of stuff. But they also have a componentized embedded version of traditional Windows, which is just called Windows Embedded. And the new version of Windows Embedded, of course, is based on Windows 7, and it just shipped. And what's really interesting about this version is that, you know, it runs on x86 hardware, right? So it's not, you know, ARM-based or the type of thing that's going to be in a router, but it's used for connected smart devices, you know, like set-top boxes. It could be put inside TV sets and things like that. And what's happened with the Windows 7 version of Windows Embedded is that for the first time, they've added a lot of the kind of, you know, end-user features from Windows, including Media Center. And Media Center is Microsoft's DVR software, and it's that, you know, the software that has the 10-foot interface for enjoying digital media, so you can use it with a remote control and all that stuff. And Media Center dates back to 2001 when Microsoft first shipped Windows XP, and it was called Freestyle back then. And when Microsoft was first developing this system, they weren't sure at the time if they were going to put it inside of a PC or if they were going to put it inside of a device like the Xbox. This is the original Xbox. That's how long
ago it was. Firmware-based?
This was. Well, no, it was just software. It was, you know, when they were originally, they had the UI, they had their notion of what they wanted to do. And one of the earliest things they had to figure out was, are we going to put this on a PC,
right,
you know, inside of Windows, or are we going to put it inside of a device like we do with the Xbox, you know, the original Xbox?
Right.
Their decision at the time was, we have to put it inside the PC. And they kind of tried to justify it with all the power of the PC and all that kind of baloney. But the truth is, I think the devices of the day just weren't powerful enough to run this interface. So they had to go with Windows. And of course, Media Center PCs never really took off in the marketplace because they're, you know, they're big and they're expensive and they're loud and they're not really good things to stick in your living room. And
it's,
you know,
too bad, because I like that category a lot. I really thought those were going to be big.
I had Media Center PCs for years, yeah, in my living room. And, you know, by the way, and I'm talking like most of them were tower PCs.
Right.
The very first big Media Center PC was an HP tower computer.
Yeah.
Right. Which is not what Microsoft. Yeah. That's not what Microsoft wanted. In fact, they were very upset about that kind of stuff because what they saw was something that would look like a stereo piece of stereo componentry.
Eventually became that.
It did. But the truth is, you know, especially in the early days when you had to do things like IR blasting to get the
right
software to control this, you know, the cable box and all that stuff. Lots of wires, lots of mess, lots of complexity. It's a computer. I mean, I used to have that comical thing where I'd have to reboot my TV because it's a computer. And sometimes computers need to be rebooted, you know. You'd have the thing where you're using it with the remote and a Windows era dialogue would come up and there was no way to click on it unless you had a mouse handy. And it was just, you know, it was kind of dumb. So over the years, you know, Media Center has evolved. I mean, you can use it now with touch screens and all that stuff. It's multi-touch capable and, you know, it does all that kind of stuff. Most people who use Media Center actually just use it on their PC. It's kind of a neat way to play digital media, even if you're just using a mouse and a keyboard. But now that Media Center is supported in this embedded version of Windows 7, Microsoft is expecting you know, TV makers, set-top box makers, and other device makers to put this system in devices now, finally. And what you're sort of creating there, if you think about it, is a Microsoft version of the Apple TV, essentially, right? It's a version of Windows that can fit, you know, it's completely componentized. So it's not the type of thing where you would have a keyboard, a mouse, and a monitor and sit in front of it like you would with a computer, although you could create that kind of a system. But you would just cut and, you know, paste the little parts of Windows that you need to you know, create like a set-top box that would be just for digital media. And so I think what we're going to see finally is the way I sort of thought this thing of should have always gone, which is a device version of Media Center. And you know, I think, you know, if it's integrated into TVs, that's one thing. I think I'd love to see cable set-top boxes that pick this thing up, because it is a beautiful interface and much nicer than anything you see on most cable TVs. So the reason I'm excited about this is that this is, I think, the chance to kind of get Media Center right. And, you know, hopefully it takes off a little bit. I'm curious to see who, if anybody, you know, runs with this on the hardware.
You won me over. Yeah.
I want it to happen. I mean, I feel bad about Media Center because it's such great software, but it's just always been hobbled ultimately by the complexity of the PC.
Now, if it's embedded, it's in firmware or it's.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's what technically embedded means, is that it's not.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it's smaller.
And it would literally be an appliance.
And it becomes an appliance. Yeah. Fast booting. All the things that really make Windows Media Center not desirable are gone. You don't.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Wow. So when are we going to see that? I mean,
well, it's out now. So hopefully by this Christmas, we'll have some devices to talk about. I mean, you know, there's a software interface for Media Center in the Xbox 360, but even today, the Xbox 360 isn't necessarily the appropriate hardware for the living room. Although, if rumors are correct,
so noisy, I would
that might be changing. So, you know, at the E3 trade show this June, there were rumors that there are going to be more home theater friendly versions of the Xbox 360 coming.
I like that.
Yeah, we'll see.
Would that be a Microsoft license, or would they do it?
They would do it in that case, you know.
But I use my PS3 as my Blu-ray player.
Yeah,
because it's quiet enough, and it looks okay, and I can keep it there as a. But I can't do that with the Xbox; it's just too noisy.
It's white.
And it's white. You
know,
yeah,
which was in vogue of the day because it kind of looked like an Apple product, you know.
It's beige.
But it doesn't look good in the living room, you know. So supposedly there'd be some black versions of the Xbox 360. Obviously there's a black version now as well, but I mean, I think the Xbox 360 is going black, I guess, from a color scheme perspective, which I think is the right way to go.
And the Elite's been black for a while.
Yeah.
In fact, the Elite is probably, I mean, that's HDMI out. I mean, that's kind of more tuned.
It's getting there. Yeah. It's the old form factor with some of the new capabilities. Yeah. The other thing I think that's notable, and I think that this points the way to where they're going with Media Center, is in the Windows Vista timeframe, there were several Media Center extenders, which were these kind of dumb devices that you could put on your TV and you could access your Media Center content over the network. So you'd have a Media Center PC in the other room, your content would be on there, and you know, you'd stream it over the network to your TV. That stuff is all gone. You know, they don't sell that anymore for Windows 7. It's all compatible. I mean, if you have Windows 7 and you have a Media Center extender for Vista, it actually still works, but the only Media Center extender on the market today is actually the Xbox 360.
People ask me this on the radio show all the time, and I cannot explain why they're gone.
I think it's because Media Center devices are coming, and they don't want to do the extenders anymore.
So companies like D-Link and Netgear and Linksys and all these companies that made these things said, oh, no, it's a bad business?
They didn't sell well. It's complicated. You know, in other words, Media Center itself is complicated. So you can put your computer in the room, in the living room. You can connect all the wires. It's complicated. So it's like, well, okay, we'll make it easier. We'll add another device to the mix. Now, put the Media Center. I actually used to have in my office a Media Center PC and a cable box. And I would control the cable box from the Media Center PC, but never output the TV to anything, because the only point of it being in there was that it would record TV. And then you could blast it out to the den, and in the den you would have an extender, and it would access that content over the network. I mean, it's just like, even describing it sounds ridiculous. You know, it's just, it's so convoluted. You know, so now if you could just have a box, they actually had the processing power on board to make this stuff happen. Plug in a hard drive and go to town. You know, everything would be in that one place. It would be an Apple TV plus DVR.
Do you think
it would be fantastic?
Intel's YDI has any legs at all? This is the thing that comes in some laptops. They touted it at CES, and then it sank without a trace. But it comes in some laptops, and it automatically lets you get a little box from, I don't know, Netgear or somebody that hooks up to your TV, and then your laptop then automatically talks to your TV and can send the TV signal to
it. It's like a wireless HDMI or something.
Yeah.
It's a little early.
They call it WiDi's wireless display.
Yeah, yeah. I think what they were trying to go for is a lot of people are watching video content on their computers, like on laptops. And whether that's YouTube or Hulu or whatever, hey, why don't we give those guys the ability to do this on their TV? I have, just for experimental purposes, I think everyone does this once. You know, you get a laptop, they all have HDMI ports on them now. So let's put this on the TV one time and see what it looks like, you know? And you're like, yeah, look at that, it works. And then, you're not going to sit there with a laptop and, I don't know. So I think this is kind of a, not a huge usage case, I think, is what I'm trying to say.
I think you're right. Somebody's pointing out in the, I just saw an article on the web, and the chat room just gave me a link to it, that Microsoft took a similar stance to Java about 10 years ago. Didn't Microsoft kind of say, oh, we don't like this cross-platform development that Java? Back to the Flash issue. They didn't do the same thing?
No. What Microsoft did was more subtly hostile to Java, which was they created their own Java environment that had hooks into the Windows API.
So it would look more native.
Yeah, and would subvert Java development, because the idea was if you wrote to this API,
that's it, you're done.
The Java applications you wrote wouldn't be compatible cross-platform.
Right. And Java, Sun sued.
Yep, and they settled.
And they basically won. And Microsoft stopped doing its non-standard
Microsoft
Java.
Did they?
Yeah.
Yeah, they don't anymore make it. I know that. Yeah.
The part of this terms of the settlement was you won't subvert the Java experience.
Well, it was it. I'd have to go back and look and see if that
it's
was
kind effective. Of the same motivation. I mean, and even you could even make the same argument.
Okay, but they don't, in other words, they don't prevent Java. But see, the Apple response would have been, Java doesn't run on our environment.
Right. We don't support it at all.
Microsoft never prevented Java. I mean, I still get Java pop-ups on certain computers. Yeah. I mean, it's still there. You know, Microsoft doesn't make their own Java, obviously. But Microsoft, since then, I mean, it's hard to remember what year this was and what the world was like at that time. But one of the things that happened in that same time frame was that Microsoft hired away from Borland, the guy whose name I now forget, Anders Hilsberg or whatever his name is, the guy who created Turbo Pascal and also Delphi. And this is the guy who created .NET.
Really?
And the C# programming language.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So in some ways, .NET is a response to many things, but it was a response to Java, right? And .NET has advantages over Java, both from a performance perspective, but also from the fact that, like I said earlier, it's multi-language. You know, you can it will support any languages, including Java. You could today, I'm sure, write Java code to .NET if you wanted to. I don't know who makes such a thing, but I mean, there's a COBOL environment for .NET. I mean, there's all kinds of things. So I think that assuming Microsoft capitulated to Sun in some way, which I'm not even sure it was entirely was the case. But if that's what happened, I'm sure part of what was going on at the time is, well, we've got this other thing that we're working on anyway, so no big deal. But absolutely, Microsoft saw Java as a threat, and I'm sure positioned their Visual J++ product, which is what that was called, as a way to utilize your Java skills to write programs that would look awesome on Windows. You know, so there was end user and developer benefit to it. I'm sure that was how they positioned it. It wasn't as openly as antagonistic as what Apple's doing, but it certainly was subtly antagonistic or passive aggressive or whatever.
I had no idea that the guy who wrote Turbo Pascal wrote C#. I think that's really cool. I mean,
it's Anders something.
Anders Hilsberg, I guess is how you pronounce it. I'm no expert in he's Danish.
No.
Danish.
But yep.
I'll have to get my...
Yeah, genius.
Yeah, that's really... I mean, you must have used Turbo Pascal. I certainly did. Loved it. It was a breakthrough.
Yeah. Yep.
It's huge, because for the first time ever...
I wrote a book about Delphi.
You're the Delphi guy. You got it on a zip disk.
When Delphi came out, Delphi's framework was called the VCL, the visual... I'm already forgetting. The visual component language?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, I can't remember what it stands for.
It seems like ancient history. It's just a few years ago.
It's so long ago. But, you know, Microsoft's object-oriented framework of the day was the MFC, the Microsoft Foundation Classes.
Right.
Horribly convoluted.
I remember that.
Well, it was a Microsoft product, but it was based on C++, which is terrible. And the whole thing was just a mess.
Right.
And, you know, the VCL was so beautiful and so elegant. And by the way, an example of a third-party development environment, like the kind Apple is trying to keep up with the iPhone, that where they would have to keep up with the underlying platform advances that Microsoft was doing, because, you know, you can't just sit still. Microsoft comes out with new, you know, a new version of Windows that has new technologies. You have to support them in some update to the VCL. It is a game, you know, where you have to keep up. But, you know, the Object Pascal language is so beautiful and so elegant and so much better than anything that was available at the time, you know, Visual Basic, which was a joke, or, you know, MFC, which was horrible, or Straight C, which was, you know, kind of on the way out because the world was going to object-oriented programming and so forth. I don't know. You know, C# is the legacy of that, I guess. And, you know, something, then that's what, if you're programmed for Windows Phone on Silverlight, that's C#. It's the natural progression of all of those things we just talked about.
Yep.
Today in Programming Weekly.
I love this stuff. I really do.
It's hard to, I got to get my mind, you know, back in this mode to even remember this stuff.
Turbo Pascal was so cool.
I used to run a Turbo Pascal emulator on the Amiga. It was an Amiga Pascal environment that emulated, you know,
Turbo Pascal.
Right. So you could enter Turbo Pascal code and it would work.
It was so fast. And you just the write compile run cycle was like this.
Yeah. And God help me, I swear to God, I miss the text mode IDE stuff.
Yeah.
And as terrible as DOS applications were, you know, for writing code, the text mode stuff was awesome.
It was, I think, in some ways, that's how people should learn how to program. I mean, very straightforward, kind of quick feedback.
Yep.
But we must move to the present.
I guess so.
And Microsoft, we talked about this on the This Week in Google, by the way. Thank you so much for being on the show yesterday. You really added some great stuff. And one of the things we talked about was Microsoft. So the Microsoft Linux, HTC.
Thing, you got to sort of wrap your mind around what's going on. Microsoft has a rich legacy, of threatening to sue companies that use or implement or sell Linux. Right, so they have have claims, intellectual property claims that on Linux. You know, the source code is out there; they can look at it, and they've said this thing violates many of our patents. Thus, anyone who uses this code, including users, right, is infringing on our patents. Thus, we expect Linux companies to pay us or to reach a license agreement with us. It could be in the form of a payment. Could be a cross-licensing agreement if they have their own patents that Microsoft can license. And, of course, this set the Linux community off in a little tizzy. But, you know, the truth is, dozens and dozens of companies have signed these agreements with Microsoft, including most of the big heavyweight companies. I think that, the notable exception might be Red Hat, if I'm not mistaken. I think they might be the only major, you know, Linux company that hasn't signed this kind of agreement. So now they're extending this same argument to Android, because Android is based on Linux. And the first company they signed an agreement with, they never actually threatened to sue them. I think they must have just approached them because they're a major partner of theirs. Is HTC. And HTC makes mobile hardware, you know, smartphones. They make smartphones that are based on Android. They also make smartphones that are based on Windows Mobile, by the way, and will be making Windows Phone devices as well.
Hmm.
So, HTC is a smaller company that really hasn't been around for a long time, does not have their own patents like an Apple or a Google or whoever would. So they're actually making a payment to Microsoft, and it's basically indemnifying the company and its customers from Microsoft's patent claims.
I wonder how much it costs.
They're not saying, obviously.
Nobody's going to ever say.
Microsoft has said that they are in talks with several other Android handset makers. So I think we can expect to see either an agreement or a lawsuit from each of those in the, you know, the next several weeks.
And why don't they go after Google? Because it's a Google operating system.
Yeah. Google, maybe they are. We don't know.
Right.
Google, of course, does make a phone.
Yeah, but I mean, Google, you know, Google could settle the whole thing by saying, well, we'll take care of this. This is, sure. I mean, Android is free. Anybody can
use
Google
it. Google is a weird enough company that they could, in fact, do that. You know, they have a bottomless pit of money. I could almost see them doing something like that. But, you know, we don't know if the companies have.
Maybe they think Google would fight it.
Well, maybe they do. You know, look, I mean, Microsoft is many things, but. As the sort of modern day IBM, I can assure you this is a company that has thousands and thousands of patents, and it would be an amazing legal battle to see these patents contested in court. You know,
well, and
I was just going to say it's inconceivable that some of them wouldn't be upheld. So, you know, companies don't want to have that happen.
Yeah, I mean. I just wish there was some way of finding this stuff out. I guess we can't.
Yeah.
We can only
speculate. I think more information is going to come out over time. But, of course, the big question here with HTC is Apple is suing HTC. And does this cross-license patent agreement with, well, I guess it's just a patent licensing agreement in this case, with Microsoft help HTC in its legal battle with Apple? Maybe. Because some of the things that Microsoft has patents on are such things as multi-touch computing and so forth.
Right.
And you have to think that some of the Apple stuff that they're suing HTC over is the multi-touch interfaces on those Android phones.
And this is why Apple sues HTC, not Google, because as always happens with a patent lawsuit, you sue the guy who doesn't have countersuit. Potential.
Yep.
Doesn't have any patents. HTC,
absolutely.
Poor HTC,
yeah.
Has no patents. So they
and have, not a lot of money.
Right.
Right. It's going to be very expensive for them to defend themselves in court, even if they're right.
It feels like being a bully to me. I don't know why.
Yeah. Well, it
doesn't
is.
Doesn't it?
But,
I mean, it's like, okay, pick on the little guy then, because he doesn't have any patents and he has no money. So he's going to just say, okay, but stay away from Google and Microsoft because
I think in the case, so Apple going after HTC is a little tough because, you know, Apple's a big company and HTC isn't. And they have no formal relationship of any kind. At least with Microsoft and HTC, you could make the argument that, you know, they're partners.
Right.
I mean, hopefully this wasn't, you know, one of those uncomfortable Godfather-like discussions or whatever. But
we'll never know.
I guess it's hard to think of it as anything but. But,
but maybe they made a deal. Maybe they said, look, you give us 10 cents a handset or something. Some insignificant amount.
Yeah.
And you're
actually,
and,
I, you know, I didn't follow up on this, but I did see a story today about how Microsoft does make a certain amount of money every time a Google handset is sold. And maybe that's based on that.
That would be because of that probably, right?
Something like that. Yeah, I think
it's
I would
all
assume so.
Interlocking. That's the funny thing. Everybody's kind of got their each. It's like I got my hand in your pocket. You got my hand in my. I mean, it's.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just, you know, who really makes money on this? You know, who makes money on this? The lawyers.
Yeah, the lawyers,
right. That's who's making money on this.
Thank God for that, really.
Oh, yeah. It's a lawyer retirement fund.
Right.
All right. So there's the news of the week. It's time now for the part you wait for all week long. Windows 7's feature of the week.
Wow.
It sucks. I got to get something better for you. Just doesn't have
we need any. A song or something.
It's time for the Windows 7 feature of the week.
You know, it's funny. This week's feature is Windows Media Player. And it's funny to me because for a couple of years now, I've been sort of questioning its need to be in Windows. You know, I feel like there are solutions like the Zune software, for example, that Microsoft makes that, you know, offer certain bits of functionality that would be really interesting to have in Windows. And why, you know, why can't they merge them or whatever? But, you know, the truth is, Windows Media Player, especially in Windows 7, has some interesting features that really aren't available elsewhere, including in Zune. So, for example, it does DVD playback, which is not available in Zune. It has a beautiful now playing mode, which is fantastic in Windows 7. It offers better format compatibility along those audio and video formats that are now very popular thanks to Apple, like AAC and H.264 MPEG-4 video.
But so you no longer need a DVD playing program on Windows. If you've got Windows 7, yeah. Any version?
Right. And man, no, I'm sorry. That's not actually true. Premium. If you have Starter, then you do not get the DVD software.
But every other version of Windows, yeah, the media player, unlike previous versions of Windows, media player now will play DVDs out of the box.
And you know, years and years ago, Windows Media Player was all Windows Media Technologies, right? If you wanted MP3 ripping, you had to pay for it.
Right.
If you wanted DVD playback, you had to pay for it. You know, they kind of went kicking and screaming to it.
Well, because they had to license all these codecs, and they figured if we have to pay for them, you have to pay for them.
Right, right. Well, Microsoft didn't pay for them. They farmed that out to third parties.
We won't pay for them.
Yeah, they didn't. You have to think if Microsoft was paying for them, the price would have been a little less exorbitant. But anyway, now it's free. So now it's just part of Windows Media Player. And that's great, in the sense that people use their computers to play DVDs. I don't know. I'm sure some people do.
It always bugged me that, I deal with, on the radio show, real people. Unlike people who listen to this network and you, I deal with normal people. And normal people say, well, I got it home and it wouldn't play DVDs.
Right.
And it just frustrates them. It's like, well, it seems like that should be, it comes with a DVD player. It should just play the DVD. So exactly. I think this is the right thing to do.
If you buy a computer with, even back in Windows XP timeframe, those computers should have come with that software. That's the PC Maker not showing up. The PC Maker was supposed to, and usually would, have included that software.
A trial version.
Well, hopefully not, but... sometimes that stuff should have just worked. Go ahead.
Microsoft's opinion was the OEM should do it
because they can pass the cost of that along to the consumer.
And they're the one putting in a DVD player in. That's a very good point. If it doesn't have a DVD player, why should Microsoft?
The problem, right? When Microsoft farms this stuff out to someone else and assumes they're going to do it right, they never do it right. They will put the trial version in or the version that doesn't work for whatever reason. And, over time, it just becomes so painful for people. They're like, okay, screw it. We're just going to, we'll just put it in. Obviously, we can't trust these people to do the right thing. So, they add it themselves, and that's fine. But I think the thing that's most interesting about Windows 7, there are two things, I guess. One is that you can share your media library not just on your home network, but out over the internet, which is really powerful. So I've done demonstrations where, I'm on stage and I actually play media from my home-based computer while on the road. And that's really cool. That's something that's not in Zune and it's not in iTunes. iTunes works great over your home network, or I should say it works over your home network. But, this thing... can reach out past your home network, which is really interesting. But there's also this this notion of Play To, which is sort of the opposite of, the whole Apple remote thing in iTunes. So if you're sitting in front of your Apple TV, for example, or you have iTunes running on a PC, you can load up a remote media library on your home network, right, from another PC, and you can play content from that library on the device you're sitting in front of, whether it's an Apple TV or another PC running iTunes. But Windows Media Player in Windows 7 kind of does this in the opposite direction. The idea is you're having a party and you walk into your home office and you've set up your little playlist for the party or whatever. From Windows Media Player, you can cause that playlist or whatever you want to play to play to another device in your home network, like the Xbox 360 out in your living room. That will go through your home theater and play that way. So you actually are controlling the playback on a different device from your PC. It could couldn't be another PC, but it can be a media center extender. It could be a connected media device that does DLNA. It can be an Xbox 360, that kind of thing. And there are arguments to be made, I guess, about which of those makes more sense and, the most time or whatever. But it is a unique bit of functionality. So I will give Microsoft credit in Windows 7. They did put some stuff in Windows Media Player that is unique. That said, in Windows 8, I really wish they would, just have the one thing. They've got Media Center playback for, that 10-foot interface. They have Media Player. They've got Zune. They've got a lot of different solutions. I'd like to see maybe the next version, if they could consolidate it down to a single thing that just does everything. But for right now, you have to mix and match.
They don't. There's no antitrust issues with that, is there? Didn't they get in trouble with the media player?
Yeah, they did get in trouble with the media player in Europe. Yeah, absolutely. But that would be a good, well, but that would be a good rationale just to leave it out.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, don't you don't and, have to include
just,
it.
And just right. Make Zune part of the Windows Live Essentials.
Somebody in the chat room is saying, the idea of including a DVD player and media player is socialist.
Yes.
You he says,
I cannot tell you the last time I played a DVD movie on a computer. I mean.
Well, you rip them though, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
But that's the only reason it goes on my computer.
Right. And then you don't need media player to do that.
No.
And now, the Windows 7 tip of the week.
This is really neat.
I love this. I saw this myself. I meant to send it to you. I'm glad you found it.
We've talked about third-party utilities like Gladinet and used to be called SkyDrive Explorer, but I think it's called SD Explorer now because apparently SkyDrive is a trademark of some kind that Microsoft owns. But there are third-party utilities that will allow you to do what Microsoft should have provided over a year ago, which is a way to access your 25 gigabytes of free SkyDrive storage from your home computer using Windows Explorer, you know, the file system. And those tools work good. They require a bit of configuration and so forth. I still recommend them if you have extensive folder structures up on the server and you want to be able to access any of that, you know, cloud-based storage from any point in that file system. Something like Gladinet or SD Explorer is still a good choice. But if you're looking just to access a single folder up in SkyDrive and you want to access it all the time, you know, maybe to back files up or whatever, there is, in fact, a very, very easy way to do this. And to do it, what you need is some version of some Office 2010 application, you know, Word, PowerPoint, Excel, whatever. It could be the beta version. It's still up there, I believe, on Microsoft.com. So if you don't have the final version yet, because it's just coming out, you can use the beta version. But basically what you do is, let me just bring this up so I can tell you exactly. Microsoft in Office 2010, obviously there's a, actually I shouldn't say obviously, it's not obvious. So there's no file menu anymore, right? There's no menu system at all in the Office 2010 applications because they have a ribbon. But if you hit Alt F or you hit that file tab that you see in all of the Office applications, you'll see what is essentially the replacement for that old file menu. And it will have options like save, save as, open, close, etc. One of the options is save and send. And from here, you can do things like save using email, save to the web, save to SharePoint, and so forth. Save to the web is designed to save the file that you're working on to Windows Live SkyDrive, that 25 gigabytes of file storage. And if you choose one of the folders on SkyDrive, it takes a second because it's hitting the web. But you'll get one of those standard Windows Save As file dialogs.
Yay.
And up in the address bar is this kind of a web dev-y looking address to SkyDrive. So you can copy that into the clipboard and then you can map it as a drive letter. And then now you always have a way to access that location in SkyDrive. Now, the reason this isn't as good as, or I should say as complete, as like Gladinet or SD Explorer, is that you can't do it for, you can't make a shortcut for this to SkyDrive. What you have to do is make a short, or I'm sorry, a mapped network drive. What you're doing is creating a mapped network drive that relates to a folder on SkyDrive. So for example, I've made one for my documents folder and I made it the S drive or whatever. So if you check off the box to reconnect at logon, every time you reboot your computer, that drive will always be available and you can use it to back up your documents online using the file system like God intended. And why this is so difficult, we'll never know. But this is a neat way to do it because Office 2010 on Windows, Office 2010 in general, exposes that address that you need to map the drive. The Windows 7 piece is that this requires you to have, obviously you have a Windows Live ID to you know, to access SkyDrive. But Windows 7 has a facility called Link Online IDs. And it's a way to link your Windows Live ID to your logon ID so that every time you hit some sort of Windows Live site through the file system, in this case, you don't have to re-log on. And what this means is as long as you're logged on to the PC, every time you hit that map network drive, you're already automatically authenticated. So you'll never get that pop-up dialog that says, please enter your credentials. And so you link your online ID, your Windows Live ID, to your Windows Live ID. I'm sorry, to your Windows password, you know, your Windows logon. And then they're automatically linked up, and this all becomes possible through, as Bill Gates would call it, the magic of software.
is that his phrase?
It is, yeah.
The magic of software.
Well, I'm so glad. I don't know if this is an oversight or
it was
what.
An oversight. It was absolutely an oversight.
Whoops. But at this point, they're not going to take it out. And it's
oh,
so
I'm
great.
Sorry. I thought you meant that it was. No, this should have been built. This should just
but
be
that's
built.
The point.
How does Windows 7 ship without this?
Well, that's the point. They put it in the office.
It's but, crazy.
But yeah. So the over... No,
the Office piece is the save as dialogue in Office just happens to show you that address.
Right.
Because it gives you the ability to save to SkyDrive. It's the first version of Office that offers this capability, right? So now you have the address.
And that's
You need that kind of weird URL.
I get it. So if you'd had that before, you could have mapped it.
Yes, you could have, yeah.
So the only question is, why were they hiding it?
Listen, this is the million-dollar question of the decade. You know, why? Let's create a bunch of different services and not connect them in any way that makes sense for people, you know?
They could have just put out a tech note that said, hey, if you want to map to your SkyDrive, here's...
How about a little button in the toolbar in Windows 7 that has a Windows Live logo on it? You click on it and it says, would you like to connect this computer to your SkyDrive all the time?
Well, that's why you have to think it was an intentional omission, that they didn't want people to do that for some reason. It's beta.
No, they've always planned to do this. It just
never got around to it. Oh, we forgot that part.
Unbelievable.
You know what I'm really pleased about? And I see this is your pick of the week.
Believe this was in there. I look for this all the time.
It wasn't in there for a long time. This is something brand new.
It is literally brand new.
I'm really excited about it. Go ahead and tell me.
I had to do a double check. I checked it like three times. I couldn't believe this wasn't in there. Because if it had been, I would have picked this a long time ago.
I think this is the Audible Frontiers thing where they're... are you talking about Audible now?
I am. Let's make sure we're talking about the same.
Mapping drive letters to SkyDrive. Okay, I thought you were talking about what you were talking about. It's our time for Audible. Audible, of course, is our sponsor. They're the great company that gives you now 75,000. That's the latest count. Downloadable titles, literature, fiction, nonfiction, periodicals, even comedy performances and old-time radio shows. Every genre. It is the ultimate bookstore of audio entertainment.
You know, eventually we're going to devolve into twin speak.
Yeah, you and I
just going to agree with each other and no one will have any idea what we talked about.
Yeah, that thing, you know, about that. Well, you're right. Yeah.
Yep. Thanks for joining us this week on Two Babbling Idiots. Don't complete a sentence.
You know, it's scary, Paul. I would be willing to bet at more than half the people listening knew exactly what we were talking about.
Exactly. Well, I'd have to think the really hardcore listeners have, in fact, brought up the show notes. And thus knew that this was the next topic.
Maybe that's it.
You know?
Yeah, because I do post those notes on FriendFeed and Buzz.
Yeah.
Two of the big platforms.
It's good stuff.
I could put them on Facebook, but no.
I would, but I can't figure out the privacy controls.
You know what? Actually, I did. I closed my personal Facebook account.
Yeah.
I deactivated it because I just...
The thing is, I have to say, I use Facebook.
I do for business.
So it's a weird one. I don't trust it, but everyone I know is on there.
Yeah, I know. So Audible has this program called Audible Frontiers, where they are recording a lot of the original classic sci-fi that was never made into audiobooks because it was in the 50s, partly, or the 60s or the 70s, but also because, let's face it, the folks who publish sci-fi don't have a lot of money. And making audiobooks is probably not number one on their list. So when I first joined Audible, I'll confess, this is in 2001, very disappointed that so little sci-fi was on there. Well, that's because nobody was doing it. Audible has since built 9 studios in their facility. They record all the time, and the Audible Frontiers program is one of the beneficiaries of this because all this great sci-fi is now on Audible. And I agree. I am about to download all of this. I've read every one of them. So thrilled that they're available now.
I have recently been going. As I talk about on and on and on. I'm trying to get rid of a bunch of the stuff in my house. So I've been interested to see which of my old books are available on the Kindle, which are available on Audible.
To get rid of the paper.
Get rid of the paper. You know, And it's in some cases there. I have run into a few that just aren't available elsewhere for whatever reason, and that's always a little depressing. But you know, Isaac Asimov is one of those big influences, and you know, the Foundation books, especially the Robot series too. A lot of his short story stuff is just, I mean, it's just it's the apex. This is the Lord of the Rings of science fiction.
Better.
And and I just love it so much. Anyway.
They've put like all of it. I think Foundation and Empire, second Foundation.
Yeah, those are the early ones. So
book two, Foundation and Empire, book three. Let's see. I mean, all of this stuff. Look at all the Asimov on here.
These date back to the 1950s, I want to say, the first one. And, you know, and he picked up it's funny, it was originally a trilogy. And then he later in the 1980s wrote more books. And they tie into it takes place in the same universe as the robot books, as I recall, and so forth. But the first one especially is...
it's a must.
That's just genius, yeah. It's absolutely fantastic.
I'm putting it right now. I got two credits. I'm putting it right now on my downloads because I would love... I just want to hear it. This is... by the way, Scott Brick, who's one of their best guys, is doing it. I'm a big fan of Scott's.
Books on Tape presents... Foundation.
Oh, that's interesting.
Isaac Asimov.
This is not an Audible production. This is Books on Tape. That's interesting.
Part 1. The Psychohistorians.
Oh, yeah.
Chapter 1. Harry Seldon. Born in the 11,988th year of the Galactic Era. Died 12,069. The dates are more commonly given in terms of the current foundational era as -79 to the...
I love a sci-fi book that begins like that.
Yeah. Harry the first Seldon. One's classic because the first book is unique in the series. It's a series of, I guess, novellas or even short stories that take place over different time spans. And that's fascinating. It's such a great book.
Oh, I love it. Scott Brick reads Isaac Asimov, now available, just came out about a week ago on Audible. All the Foundation books are there now, and you can get it free. If you have not yet tried Audible, and I can't imagine there's still somebody listening to the show who hasn't, but at some point Audible's going to say, we don't need to do any more ads. We actually have every one of your listeners now.
Yeah, we're done. Yeah.
I know. I keep expecting this. In fact, at this point, I think they stay on just because they like us. It's just for old time's sake. It's like, well, we'll buy ads. We're not...
It's hard to imagine some alternate reality, but Audible's nice because I really do use it, and I'm a big reader, period, and across multiple formats. But Audible's great. I mean, it's the easiest thing in the world to talk about. If this was, I'm trying to imagine what else it could be, but whatever else is, I mean, it's just nice because it's the right thing. I mean, it's just,
it's a great
sponsor. It's something I really do use. Yeah.
In theory, the idea of our advertising, we take very little advertising, you know, and we try to take advertising we use that way. Mm-hmm. We can, you know, honestly say, this is great. You got to try it.
Yeah.
Free. Go to audible.com/windows. You get that signs up for the gold account. That's a book a month, which I think is kind of the minimum. I do two a month. You can see I have two credits, which is so exciting. I renew on the 22nd, so it's been a week since I renewed.
I didn't think I had a credit, but I just noticed I have one.
This is exciting. Audible.com/windows. You get your first one free. It's yours to keep. You can cancel it anytime. So there's no obligation. The idea is really to get a sense of what it's like listening to an audiobook. If you are one of the handful of people who have not yet joined Audible, please, this is your chance. Audible.com/windows. We thank them so much for their support of Windows Weekly. Foundation. Yay! All right. Now we have a couple of software picks, I believe. I like the name of the first one.
I know. It's actually an Adobe Air app, go figure, but it's the latest version of some software that's been around for a while, and they've gone cross-platform, but it's called Peekaboo 10. Peekaboo. And this is one of those photo book solutions. And I've been using it lately to create some photo books from the trips we went on last year. I haven't caught up on that yet. But it's peekaboo.com, peekaboo.com. And this is really nice software. And I have to say, you know, when I think, about the Mac versus the PC and so forth, I mean, the one thing that is sorely lacking on the PC is some of the functionality from iLife. And what this gives you is a very Mac-like way to create photo books. And it's a wonderful application. And I've used different things over the years, including iLife, by the way. iPhoto has a photo book capability as well. But there are different applications on the PC that are decent, you know, my publisher and so forth. And I've made books probably on all of them at one point or the other. But
what's your favorite right now?
Well, right now it's actually this, which is why I recommended it. You know, they came out with this new version, and it's, you know, what you're looking for is not just, you know, good templates and good layouts and that stuff, but the ability to customize things at a level that just really wasn't possible before. And I would say before this version of the software, no matter what you were using, you know, you basically had to, you know, make this thing work within a very specific kind of template. And I think what I really like about this one is just the ability to really go in and change every single page, including, you know, the background pattern or image. You can apply your own photographs as sort of like watermark looking, you know, backgrounds on pages and so forth. It's really, really
this nice. Is nice.
It's, yeah, and it's a nice, nice looking application. And I think
I'm installing it right now. This is great.
Yeah, no, I mean, you as a Mac guy, I think will appreciate.
Making books is such a great thing these days because you know, with digital photography, we don't have prints. And so it tends to just sit in the computer, never be seen again. And if you have a great series of, say, 20 to 30, 40 pictures from a trip, turning it into a book is it's just a great way to do this.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, we don't put all of our photos in books, but we like to, you know, special events, trips,
if it's an event. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just think, you know, the capabilities that you have now around that stuff is
incredible. Now they have everything from the inexpensive $10 book to a $350 leather bound coffee table book.
Yeah.
That would be good for a wedding album or something like that. But 11x14, I mean, it's huge.
Yeah. I can look back at my old photo books and I can tell, you know, the era it was made in because, like, you know, here's the one where they had a hole in the front cover with a photo coming through. And, you know, you can sort of see, you know, how they changed over time.
Yeah, but, yeah.
It's just, yeah, these are just really nice.
This is very nice. And so, but what is the company that makes these? Is it just, it's not like Blurb or somebody?
Yeah, actually, I'm not sure. I haven't printed any from this one yet, but I had this suspicion in the past. I think that my publisher is, in fact, or was, in fact, the company that made the Apple stuff, right? That they were, in fact, the ones printing those.
Right. Yeah, well, they all use a service. Nobody, you know, Apple doesn't publish them directly.
Right. So it seemed like for a while they were all using exactly the same service because you could look at the, you know, the type of covers and they were always the same. So I haven't printed one on this. But if you look at the sheer number of, you know, book types and the cover types, I mean, something wonderful has happened in this market.
Yeah.
I mean, the capabilities here. It's a neat app. And by the way, speaks to how awesome a cross-platform app can be, right?
I mean, yeah. In Air. There you go. Adobe Air.
Nice.
Before we get to your second pick, Gizmodo has a scooplet, and I don't know how much we trust Gizmodo for scooplets.
Not
these
at all,
days.
But please continue.
But according to Gizmodo,
Microsoft cancels the courier tablet they never announced.
Right.
It's like the thing we first uncovered, but you'll have to trust us on this because no one else ever actually verified.
Right.
Is now no longer exist. This is almost like they were badgering Microsoft. Like, you got to talk about this. And they're like, we're not making one.
There never was.
And now it's like exclusive. They're not making it now.
So do you believe that the courier never existed?
Look, I'm not connected with every single, you know, group at Microsoft. I have never, ever heard anyone say that this thing existed. And no one has ever suggested that this thing was coming.
It was always seemed like it was a labs project. It was R&D.
Right. I think that it never went beyond, you know, Photoshop. Here are the possibilities, you know.
They're quoting Frank Shaw. He says, at any given time, we're looking at new ideas, investigating, testing, incubating them. It's in our DNA to develop new form factors. I think this is boilerplate. And natural user interfaces to foster productivity and creativity. The Courier project is an example of this type of effort. It will be evaluated for use in future offerings, but we have no plans to build such a device at this time. Yeah, Gizmodo has really essentially turned... they made egg salad. they've turned what was a non-story that they were promoting as a story into a story that is canceled.
This site is so busy trying to be the news that I just don't think they understand how ridiculous they are. I don't get it.
Wow. Yeah, every time we talked about the Courier, we would have to say, you know, this unannounced product from Microsoft. Announced by Gizmodo.
Sure.
Okay, thank you. Software pick of the week two.
It is the unfortunately named Windows Phone 7 Developer Tools CTP Refresh.
Oh, finally.
If you're not up on this, back in February or March, I guess it was March at Mix, Microsoft released a beta version of the developer tools for Windows 7. And then this past month, they released the final version of Visual Studio, which is not compatible with the beta version of the tool. So now this developer tools refresh means that you can use the final shipping version of Visual Studio 2010 to develop applications for Windows Phone. So it's just an update to those developer tools to make sure that it works on the shipping versions of Microsoft's development environment.
And I, if you could send me an updated link, because the link that I just posted actually brings us to the login for your blog.
Oh, sorry. So if you just, right. So
I'll fix that.
It's the top story on Windows Phone. So yeah.
Okay, that's easy.
Sorry.
No. I just don't want to,
I'm curious if this is me just being old or whatever, but I've actually had a problem with copy and paste in Windows 7 lately on my PC.
And like, I don't know.
Yeah. So in other words, I will copy and paste, and what it pastes is something that was in there from before.
Something old. You're not running some sort of weird clipboard utility.
No. So I'm wondering if my keyboard's bad, if I am just getting old, or I don't know.
I keep typing L and Q comes out.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the numeric keyboard is enabled on my laptop, and I'm typing numbers, and I don't know why.
It's kind of like this computer is not working right anymore.
Yeah.
Okay, it's windowsphonesecrets.com, and that's right on the front page, top of the front page there.
There you go.
With Paul and his cup of coffee, his nose buried in a mug of Joe. And that's how I want to be buried.
Buried?
Bury me in a mug of Joe. Maybe I'll wake up.
Right.
You never know. Paul, once again, a rockin' show. We killed the Courier.
Yep.
The thing
we hardly knew ye.
That never lived. Yeah. We sold off Palm.
Right.
We released a new version of Windows Home Server. We convinced Leo that Embedded wasn't so very bad.
Right. We'll get you on Server next.
Man, this show has been a revelation to me.
Yes, it's a revelation to many people, including me.
That's why you must listen every single week.
That's when you say, you're a revelation.
You're a revelation. No, I've been doing that, by the way. You got me doing that at home. My wife hates you and me.
Sorry.
So join the club. If you come over to visit, you'll be sleeping in the doghouse too.
Okay.
You can find Paul's super stuff at the Windows super site for Windows, winsupersite.com. And I guess that also links to your Windows Phone Secrets blog.
Go ahead.
WindowsPhoneSecrets.com. Also, he is the news editor for Windows IT Pro. And the new book, out how soon for Windows Phone Secrets?
Hopefully in September.
When the phone comes out?
Yep.
The KIN, I think I said something wrong on the radio show. The KIN is not Windows Phone 7. It's Windows 6.5, right?
It's based on Windows Phone 7, it's not the same OS. It's just the same underlying.
The UI is the same.
No, actually, the UI is different, but there are little bits that are the same. You know, the Zune software is in there. Okay. That's the same.
Right. So it's not exactly 6.5. It's more like 7.
It's more like 7.
Okay. Yeah. So I wasn't wrong.
I don't know enough about this to tell you if you were wrong or not, but.
I don't know enough about nothing.
I don't know.
Same kernel, some components are the same.
Yeah.
And then the Zune skin.
Yeah, there you go.
You can watch us do this show if you if you like to see it with profanities.
You're unemployed or.
Yeah, right. You're not working during the day. You can have the profanities intact if you watch. We do it Thursdays at 2 p.m. Pacific, 11 a.m. Eastern, vice versa. 2 p.m. Eastern, 11 a.m. Pacific.
I really want to do the iPad show.
And Paul will be the new anti-editor of our iPad show. He'll do the thing where he comes on and says, "Are you guys high?"
Yeah, exactly. And then every once in a while, it just has to be the blank stare, like.
Wait a minute. Let me get that. Hold on.
You know, like.
Okay, we got it. Again, you don't have to do any work. We're going to snip up those little clips and we're going to throw it in the show. Paul Theriot, anti-editor of the Windows iPad show. Did I say Windows iPad? Now I'm really confused.
It would just be, yeah, like, yeah, that was interesting when Microsoft did it 8 years ago. Yeah, I remember when I first used my first tablet, too. Only it wasn't last week. It was in 2001.
You're a tool.
Yeah.
Okay. That's going to be fun. I'm actually really looking forward to that. I think people will tune in just for that. You're an anti-editor. Paul Theriot, thank you, sir. We will see you next week on Windows Weekly.
Honestly, it would just involve. This is all it would be. You guys would go blather on and on about some stupid, non-essential thing, and then you'd be like, "Paul, what do you think about this?" And I'd be like, "Are you f-ing kidding me?"
Yes. And
that would be almost all I ever said.
You just said it. I'll take that recording and we'll just use it.
Like, oh, all right. God,
I'll just use it in every show. At the end of every show, it'll just be Paul going, like, "Are you?" Oh.
I'm going to open my eyes and you guys are going to be gone.
That's it. You know? That's all I want you to do on that show. That's perfect.